Well, welcome everyone to Homebrew Con. Have you had your coffee? Are you awake? Do you have your burrito? Well, welcome to this wonderful, wonderful talk with Brett Coleman Baker of Urban Artifact here from Cincinnati. He's the COO and founder. They've been in business for 8 years. They use the most fruit of any brewery in the U.S., over 1 million pounds. So this is the expert. So I want you to take notes. I also want you to remind you to silence your phones. We all love your ringtones, but not today. So please silence your phones. Questions he'll take at the end of the talk. So let's enjoy and let's welcome him to the stage.
Thank you. Thank you, Annie. That was very nice. Okay, before we jump in, you're probably wondering why you got a bunch of fruit puree in a glass. So, some bad news. I shipped a pallet of beer, and it didn't make it. It's stuck in the middle of America. There's some issue with the trucking companies, yada, yada, yada. We don't have beer. We're going to do a nice taste of four different beers, try different ways to use fruit, some cool stuff. It would have been great. So, instead, I'm going to teach you how to make a smoothie beer, a smoothie fruit beer. It's really easy. You take your fruit and you mix your beer. You're done. So, obviously, the smoothie fruit style being what it is and popular in craft beer right now and selling like crazy and blah, 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 there's not a lot to it. That's it. So, there's a bunch of different fruits going around. There's some nice lager going around. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but I wanted to give you a heads up why you're getting fruit right now. So, I got more information than time. Obviously, that's always how it goes. So I'm going to stick around after questions for more questions if you have them. And I'll also be at the Boron booth over booth 700 near BSG. I'll be hanging out there most of the next 3 days. So swing on by if you have questions towards the end. Live recording archive for all of the presentations can be found. You'll see this again. Don't worry, but you can see the address there. You'll find all these seminars. If there's one that is happening right now or a different time that you missed, go back, check it out. We don't need to see my face again. So we were going to do Key Punch for the first beer. It's a nice key lime beer. It used to be a Goza, not really anymore for us for a bunch of variety of reasons. But, you know, just imagine you're tasting citrus right now before you dive into that smoothie beer. Okay, so we use over 1 million pounds of fruit a year. We only do fruit beer. Everything we do is tart to a degree. We have a house lactobacillus that we use, blah, blah, blah. Everything gets fermented. We use a lot of fruit. We have a lot of experience. There's a lot of fruit knowledge that is kept secret fermentation-wise. There's a lot out there that you can pull from the wine world, from cider making, from perry making. And then, surprisingly enough, India has a really large fruit wine culture that's not like Middle America fruit wine where it's just back-sweetened grape juice with syrups dumped into it. It's actually legitimately good fruit wine like grape wine is. So I pulled a lot of information from there, and over the years I've kind of distilled it down into this presentation that we're going to get. I'm going to try to focus more on practical aspects, thinking about brewing with fruit, thinking about flavors, what happens during fermentation, all of that wonderful stuff. So let's dive right into it. Fruit, it's really big right now. I mean, flavor is the hot word in the craft beer industry. Everybody's talking about flavor, whether it's RTDs, seltzers, or flavored craft beverages. That's the big thing. So it's great. It's accessible. Everybody knows fruit. Everybody's probably eaten fruit at some point in their life. And, you know, fruit just ferments well. It's got nutrients. It's got sugar. It's got great flavor. So it's only a natural fit to mix fruit with beer. There's tons of opportunities. There's basically unlimited innovation out there. There's not really much stylistically. I know BJCP has, what, fruit beer category? That's just a catch-all for anything that has fruit in it. Well, that would be like having a hop category for anything with hops in it. There is thousands of different options that you can do with fruit. So the sky is really the limit on how you want to use it. It's great because you can find local fruit, you can forage for fruit, you can get new and unique fruits depending on where you shop, and you know, you can take the home fermentation skills that you learn with beer, apply it to fruit, make fruit wines, make mead. It all kind of comes around, you know. Fermentation's fermentation. So there's a lot of fruit products out there. So we're going to talk a little bit about them to kind of make sure we're all using the same language during this presentation and we're all on the same page. You have fresh fruit, which I think we all know what fresh fruit is, right? You can get it at the grocery store. You can get it at the farmer's market. You can pick it on a tree out in your backyard. You can find it on the ground. You can get fresh fruit basically anywhere. It has a lot of pros and cons. The nice thing about our scale, the homebrew scale, is that, you know, a lot of the cons that might be an issue at my scale don't really apply. If we have a little bit higher loss when we're making 10 gallons at a time, so what? We just have a little bit higher loss. If you're dealing with seeds, when you're, you know, having to pit 10 pounds of cherries, yeah, it might take you an hour, but that's better than having to pit 10,000 pounds of cherries. So a lot of the cons that comes with fresh fruit, we can really overcome. You can buy fresh, whole, frozen fruit, which is quite great. It's picked fresh and then frozen immediately. Now, the difference between that and the stuff you find at the grocery store is that the stuff at the grocery store was picked unripe and then force ripened in transit or in a warehouse once it gets to the location. So you're actually going to get generally better quality from buying frozen stuff than you would from buying fresh stuff. Now, there's some myths out there, too, about, like, if it's frozen, then potentially it's more aseptic than fresh. And that might be true. It might not. It really shouldn't impact too much of what we're doing anyway. There's a lot of stuff out there about, oh, if you freeze it, you're breaking your cell walls open and you get better extraction and flavor and color and stuff. I mean, if you look at it under a microscope, sure. But in practicality, if you're putting fresh stuff in and you're putting frozen stuff in and you give it enough time, they're both going to break down completely. So the frozen stuff about like needing to thaw, refreeze, which I've read before on different forums, you don't need to do any of that stuff either. You don't need to make working with fruit harder than you would any other adjunct or grain or hops. Dehydrated fruit, this exists. Avoid it. You don't need it. We live in the modern world. We don't need dehydrated fruit. You know, they made wits with dehydrated orange peel back in the day because you know where oranges don't grow? Belgium. You know where you can get fresh oranges today? Everywhere, easily, all the time. So don't buy dehydrated. Dehydration, the only thing it does is it removes water and flavor with heat. You're cooking it, right? Why would you cook fruit? Do you like eating cooked fruit outside of jams and pies? Like, no. Especially with peel. Why would you, and that's another thing. Don't ever add fruit to the boil kettle, which we'll get to. Just, there's never value of adding fruit to a boil kettle. Never. Zero. I don't care what the ingredient is. If it comes from fruit, it does not go in the boil kettle. Do not add heat to fruit. So, dehydrated, avoid it. It's just heat and water removal, and you're just destroying flavor. And you're also ruining color. So avoid dehydrated fruit. Freeze-dried on the entrance. On the other hand, for instance, is great. Freeze-dry is wonderful. It's a low-temperature water removal. Now, the nice thing about freeze-dry is that it doesn't have water. And water dilutes your beer. Fruit is like 80% to 90% water. So if you're diluting your beer with water, you're lowering the alcohol content, you're lowering the impact of your malt, you're lowering the impact of basically all your other ingredients. It's not additive, which we'll get into. But with freeze-dried, you're basically adding DME, except it's fruit. You're adding fruit ME. It's great. You can add as much freeze-dried as you want to get as big as impact as you want. Now, the cons with freeze-dried is, well, it's dried, so you're going to have a way higher loss because it's going to absorb a lot of beer. And it's really expensive, like $25 to $30 a pound expensive. Now, again, this is a beauty of the homebrew scale. Is like, okay, so I'm going to buy 3 pounds of freeze-dried. It's going to cost me $90, but you know what? Now I have this 12% ABV fruit beer that's got the equivalent of 1 pound of freeze-dry is equal to about 11 pounds of fresh. So you're talking about getting some serious value and some serious flavor concentration that you wouldn't get otherwise. When you start passing over about the 5 to 6 pound per gallon threshold on fruit, you're no longer concentrating fruit flavor. You're just increasing dilution ratio. So through freeze-dry, you can actually soar right past that 5 to 6 pounds per gallon mark of fruit intensity, and you can make it as intense as you want. You can get fruit flavors and fruit intensities that aren't even physically possible otherwise with freeze-dried stuff. It's really, really fun, and there's some really cool things you can do with it. It's just expensive, but it's great and a lot of fun to innovate with, and the flavor and aromas are perfectly preserved. It's cold temperature, vacuum, basically removal of water. So it maintains all that flavor in a dry format. Really great stuff. P- puree, this is probably what you're going to find at your homebrew shops. It's what's most readily available, and it's going to give you the easiest to work with bang for your buck versus whole fruit. It's basically whole fruit seeds removed is what a puree is supposed to be. Now, we'll talk about different types of purees here in a bit, but a good puree is just 100% fruit, seeds removed, skins and pulp and juice intact. Because the skins is where all those tannins are, where you're going to get that astringency and that flavor balance. And it also is where a lot of your anthocyanins and your color compounds are located. So you're going to get your best color impact. You're going to get your best palate impact from purees. Now, on the other hand, juices are even easier to work with, but you don't get the benefit of that palate grippiness. You get more of like what happens when you make white wine and you just take the juice and you ferment it out, and you don't get the same level of grippiness that you would with an orange wine or a red wine. So to me, I really like the purees, and it's great to balance, and it's a lot of fun to think about. If I'm getting these tannins from these fruit skins that I'm using, I don't need the same tannins and bitterness from my hops that I would otherwise. You're just adding bitter on top of bitter, and they're almost two different types of bitterness. You know, they're both bitter, they're both astringent on the palate, but they kind of clash a little bit. So I know fruited IPAs are a big thing, but it's one of my least favorite fruit styles for the very fact that fruit bitterness doesn't go with hop bitterness. Now, citrus IPAs are different because you're just going for aromatic compounds from the citrus to blend with the hops, so that works a little bit better. But generally, you want to think about how do these tannins and how does this bitterness interact with the bitterness that I'm providing through my hops. Now, obviously, there's a whole lot of different hopping techniques to reduce bitterness, and you can leverage those in addition to the tannins from the fruit to get something that is better than the sum of their parts, so to speak. But just be aware of bitterness in hops. You can get fruit concentrates. You can get puree and juice concentrates. Concentrates are basically water-removed juices or purees. You're concentrating it up the sugar levels. Now, you do have a little bit of aromatic loss. You do have a little bit of flavor loss. But if it's a good concentrate, you should still have some of that color and grippiness that you would get from the skins in a good concentrate. Extracts, essences, flavorings. This is basically distilled oils from fruits. It could be natural, it could be not. And it's generally used to give the smell of fruit. These extracts, these flavorings, they don't have any taste. It's all aroma. Now, taste is obviously 80% aroma or whatever they say it is. But if you hold your nose and you taste some of these extracts, you're not actually going to taste anything. So if you do use extracts, there ain't nothing wrong with that. Tons and tons of breweries use them. What I found that you get the best results for is using it to top up, in addition to using purees or juices, so you get the palate flavor that you want. You can top it up with some extracts in order to get the aromatic intensity that you might not otherwise have. And then there's also one-offs. One-offs are with other natural flavors. So basically, you're taking like a white grape juice or an apple juice, and then you're adding flavors from other different fruits and extracts from other things in order to mimic what would be a puree, but do it cheaply. You're not going to see a lot of those. Something like amaretti kind of gets pretty close to what a one-off is, or Torani syrups or anything along that nature, if you've seen it at your homebrew stores or at a coffee shop, for instance. That's what those are. Those are okay. They're very sweet. They're usually back-sweetened with a ton of sugar. It's basically a syrup. So you just got to be aware. The whole point of all this is just be aware of the ingredient you're using. Just because it says raspberry on the label doesn't mean it's just straight 100% raspberry. It could be a raspberry concentrate. It could be a raspberry extract. It could be a raspberry one-off. But if you don't know what it is, how can you properly use it? Just like your different hop compounds and your different hop things you can use, pellets, extracts, whole leaf, and they have different impacts, so do all of these impact the different fruits and how you use them. See, this is when we would have tried our second beer, Gadget. This is blackberries and raspberries. Thank you. So the good news is maybe it'll show up on time Friday late, and we'll have it Saturday. So I don't know. I'm sorry. Let's talk a little bit more about fruit purees. We hit some of this, so I'm not going to go too much more in depth. But just if you can see down here in the bottom right, these are two different products that are being sold as purees. You tell me that one on the right's a puree. It ain't a puree. It's like a puree, but it's not 100% fruit puree. The one on the left, that's what you want to look for when you're buying purees. You're going to want to buy quality, right? That's why we're all here. We're homebrewers. Why did this whole thing start in the first place? Because beer was shit in the 60s and 70s, and we wanted to make something better. So treat your fruit like we treat beer, better. Puree is made, usually it's aseptic, what you're going to find. You can find frozen. I like to buy frozen. I can buy frozen. I work at a different scale. What you're going to find at your homebrew shop is aseptic. And that's okay. It just means that it's been cooked a little bit higher temperature for a little bit longer, and then it was packaged aseptically. So whether it's hot pack or whether they cook it after it's been packaged. But generally, it's had a little bit more work done to it. Now, this can be okay for a lot of fruits, but there's some fruits that just don't translate as well to an aseptic packaging. Raspberry, for instance, I've seen crazy variation on quality. These more delicate fruits can't handle as much heat. And even aseptic packaging where you're not quite boiling it, it still could potentially be too much heat and it's going to impact the flavor in a negative way. So try any of your purees before you buy them, before you buy a lot of them. Maybe buy a small package, see how it works. If you're going to ferment it versus not ferment it, that all needs to be taken into consideration. There are some fruits that really do benefit from some heat, though. Have you ever had a blueberry? Yes, I hope. Yeah? They don't taste like much, right? They're tart and sweet and blue. They don't have a lot of flavor. So blueberries, they get a little bit more flavor concentration via cooking them. You get a lot of that color pulling out of the skins. You get some of these compounds that develop that actually make it taste more like what people expect a blueberry to taste like. So blueberry, for instance, is something that I really think can do well with a little bit of heat behind it. Strawberry is another good example. Strawberry, it's very light fruit. It's very delicate. And the weird thing about strawberries is there's compound in the seeds that when fermented, it makes your beer taste like the inside of Hulk hands. You remember those plastic things and that really plasticky smell? Well, there's a compound in the seeds that will do that during fermentation. But if you cook the strawberries and you make them into a compote, you boil off that precursor compound, and not only do you get a little bit better color development out of your strawberries, which if you've ever fermented straight strawberry before, it looks flesh colored. It's kind of ugly. It doesn't look nice and red and pretty. It's a weird tan. But if you cook them a little bit, you get some more red extract, and you don't get any of that weird off flavor either. So this was something that bugged us for about 2.5 years before we finally figured it out at our brewery 6 years ago. So don't make the same mistake I did. If you're buying fresh strawberries, you really need to cook them if you're going to keep the seeds in there. Sourcing fruit. A lot of options, right? Fruit everywhere. You can go to the farmer's market, which I highly recommend if you're getting full whole fruit. Definitely go to the farmer's market. Grow it in your backyard. Avoid the grocery store for the reasons we mentioned earlier. Frozen, if you're going to go to the grocery store, is the way to go. Frozen fruit is quite fantastic. The homebrew store, you're going to have some puree options. It's usually Oregon Fruit or Vintner's Best, which is the same brand. There's some other options out there as well. I would just ask them if they can bring in another variety. See if you can get two different fruit purees to try. Don't be beholden to just the one brand that your homebrew shop carries. They will carry something else if you ask. And then there's fruit products, like we talked about. There's Loran oils, Amaretti. All this stuff is usually found at grocery stores or online. So there's a lot of options. It's pretty easy to source fruit at our scale, though. It's a lot of fun. My favorite thing is going to the farmer's market, talking with your farmer, and then asking about the weird stuff. Where can I get those Arkansas black apples? Hey, are you growing any golden raspberries? Hey, I heard about this black raspberry. Do you know where I can get some? The stuff that you're not going to find easily, that to me is the most fun. It's going on an adventure, trying to find these fruits that you're not otherwise going to find. This is where we would have tried a beer that was half gadget, half unfruited base that I then topped up with some extract so we could kind of see how that works. But you just have to imagine that it's kind of fake smelling. Okay. Imagine if the first apple you ever tried was a Red Delicious. You'd probably be like, apples are shit. I hate apples. But there's so many apples. So when you're thinking about fruit, you got to think about variety, just like with your hops. If you've had a mango and you didn't like mango, it's probably because the mango type you got was bad. If you had your exotic fruit store, like in Cincinnati, we have this place called Jungle Gyms, and they carry all sorts of stuff. They have rambutans regularly. Rambutan, amazing. But at Jungle Gyms, normally, they're bad because they ship them overseas, they're way overripe, they're starting to go off. They just don't taste like it would be if it's fresh. So it's really important to consider that maybe the first time you had this new type of fruit, you either didn't like the variety or it wasn't the right ripeness. In addition, there's a lot of different flavor impacts that you're going to get from these different types of fruits. Red Delicious, for instance, bland, plasticky, mealy, gross, right? But Honeycrisp, sweet, tart, super crunchy. Granny Smith, really sour, really punchy, not as sweet. All of those things that apply to fruit, apples specifically, apply to all the fruits. There's so many varieties of everything out there. And what you see at the grocery store is only one very specific type. This is another reason why it's important to work at your farmer's market and get to know who you're dealing with and the farmers that you're buying fruit from, because then you can get these more exotic things. You can learn what type of raspberry specifically do you like. Do you like, you know, ever-bearing crop? Do you like crop that comes around once a year and then that's it? There's a whole bunch of different factors that impact taste. Cherry is a good one. Sweet or sour, right? Eating-wise, you probably prefer sweet. The black cherry, for instance, or like the Queen Anne, the white cherry. But for brewing, sweet cherries, they're like blueberries. The only thing you really get is color and sweetness. And when you ferment out that sweetness, what are you left with? Not much. So black cherry, doesn't work well in fermentation. But sour cherries, awesome for fermentation, because they have the acidity that's going to come through at the end. They have way more tannic character in the skins, so you're going to get that cherry bite in your beer, and the aroma is better on a sour cherry. And there's tons of different types of sour cherry. You have Morellos, which are like your traditional Belgian-style cherry that used to make creeks. You have your Montmorency, which is the sour cherry of choice here in the United States. You have a new type of cherry called the Balaton that's a descendant of the Montmorency. But it's darker and it's got more flavor, but it's still got the kick, that acidity, and it's got a higher cinnamonic acid content in it. And so if you use a good amount of Balatons and you ferment them out, you actually get this cinnamon character off of the fruit that you don't get off of Montmorencies or Morellos. So knowing how these different fruit types work, experimenting with different fruit varietals, you can get some really cool flavors that you wouldn't know you would be able to get if you just don't ferment it, or if you're just using, you know, a type that wouldn't work, like a sweet cherry, for instance. Country of origin matters. Growing location matters. I know that in the Pacific Northwest, they say they have the best berries. I'd argue that they have the best strawberries. Now, more strawberries are grown in California than anywhere else in the country, but Pacific Northwest has better climate for more strawberries, or for better tasting strawberries. But you get more of them here in California. So that's why all the strawberries you see in the store are grown here, but the ones that actually taste the best are grown up north. Citrus. Everyone thinks, oh, Florida citrus, that's the best. Florida oranges. False. What I found the best oranges to be are actually from California. I don't know what it is, but it the terroir of where these are grown, even if it's the same navel orange, it really does matter. So start to look at, when you're buying your fruit, where is this also grown? If I want to do this again, am I buying it from the same exact location? Blueberry. It has two different varietals. You got the high bush and the low bush. The low bush are those really tiny ones. The wonderful thing about low bush blueberries is that they're tiny, which means that there's more skin to inside. And the inside part is the part that doesn't have any taste. The skin is where the color and the tannins and the flavor is. So if you have more ratio of skins to inside, you're going to have a better impact from your blueberry. So blueberry, for instance, we've had really good luck with low bush blueberries, not so much with the high bush. So these are all things to consider. For your citrus, are you going to use puree, peel, or juice? Juice, very easy to use, no loss, not much aromatic compound, also really high citric acid content. So it's going to be really punchy, so you can't use that much of it either. Peel, on the other hand, if you go too deep, it could be pithy, it could be bitter on the palate, like a harsh bitter. But if you use peel, you're going to get way more aromatic punch out of it. Or you're going to split the difference and get a citrus puree, or puree your own. Or zest it, get rid of the pith, and then juice it, and then mix those two together for getting better impact. But thinking about the flavor compounds, tasting, eating the peel, seeing that bitterness, I know eating peel doesn't sound attractive, but you'll get a note of what I'm talking about if you take a big bite out of that lemon peel and you get that bitterness. You can see and feel it stick to your palate. That's the type of bitterness I'm talking about. Orange. Sorry, I'm thirsty. Orange, blood orange, cool name, right? Looks cool. Blood orange is like my least favorite orange by a large margin. It's not very sweet. It's not very aromatic. It's not very much of anything. I'd rather use navel oranges over blood oranges, personally, because the aromatic intensity is better. The juice flavor is nicer. But blood orange looks cool, right? Sounds cool. So it often gets picked. Another thing that's just like that is dragon fruit. If you've never had a dragon fruit, they look cool, right? They're bright red or bright white on the inside, speckled with all those seeds. It doesn't taste like much of anything. It's a little sweet, kind of tomato-y, but there's nothing to it. All the dragon fruit you've ever had, more than likely, if it's in a juice or something, it's topped up with a tropical fruit punch flavor on the back end to just give it some flavor intensity because it doesn't really have it. Prickly pear is the same way. Prickly pear is earthy. It's almost like a beet, but grown on a cactus, and that's bright pink. It looks really cool, but the flavor is meh. But if you mix that prickly pear with some orange and a little bit of pineapple, oh, baby, we got a stew going. Arrested Development. Hopefully you guys got that. Some more. Oh, gosh. I told you this was going to go on long. There's so much to do still. I'm going to punch through this. I'm going to show you this really cool thing, and then we're going to turn it over to questions here really soon. So these are things I want you to think about when you're designing a fruit beer recipe. Do you want it to be a fruit-first flavor or a beer-first flavor? Because that's really important, right? Because it's going to impact it. You know what the number one thing why my beer gets trashed at professional beer competitions? Doesn't taste enough like beer. That is what we get hammered on every single time. So I don't know how to write back, well, that's the point, but that's kind of the point. So you need to think about that for what you're doing as well. Do I want beer first or do I want fruit first? Do I want to complement or do I want to contrast with what's going on here? You got to think about the impact the fruit's going to have. Some fruits don't impact the same way other fruits do. Your berries, for instance, are going to hit a lot harder than like a mango, especially after fermentation. Some fruits, like mangoes, really high in sulfur compounds. So if you're fermenting your mango, use a low sulfur-producing yeast. Also, give it some more time to clean up that sulfur-producing compound. Don't make a mango lager with an Oktoberfest yeast, or you're going to get a sulfur bomb that's going to take 6 months or more to age off. Some of this stuff doesn't really apply because it's a little bit more towards thinking about customer expectations, which doesn't matter for you guys. Yeast is another big one. Are you going to get a yeast that's going to actively try to biotransform or not? When are you going to add it? So I talked about not adding it to the kettle. Don't ever add it to the kettle. Add it to your fermenter. I like to add it two to three days after fermentation starts. So I'll pitch 2 to 3 days later. I add my fruit. Add extra nutrient when you pitch your fruit. So you can't really use too much nutrient. I mean, you can, but follow the dosing guidelines. If you double that and add it once at the beginning and then once when you add your fruit, that's fine. You're not going to hurt nothing. So think about when you add your fruit, and you're going to get some cool biotransformations going on. No one's ever complained that wine doesn't taste grapey enough, right? No one gets mad that wine tastes like all these wonderful flavors that wine can taste like. No one complains this cab doesn't taste enough like grapes. Well, you know what people complain about with fruit beers, at least like consumer level? That this beer doesn't taste enough like fresh raspberries. Well, yeah, I fermented it. Of course it doesn't taste like that. But it's something, point being, is that these transformations, these biotransformations are going to happen, and you're going to see a difference from fresh fruit to fermented fruit. And that's fun. That's the fun of it. That's the skill and the artistry that we get to experience as homebrewers of how does this fruit change with fermentation and how am I going to coax the best flavors out of the finished product, not the starting ingredients. Okay. Oh, no. We did get to this. If you're going to do a smoothie-style beer, just keep it in your fridge, right? Don't take it out. It's going to re-ferment unless you stabilize it, which I don't recommend doing. I mean, we have the ability not to do that because we have kegerators and all that wonderful stuff. But just keep it cold. You're adding unfermented product, right? Fruit, it dilutes beer. This is a calculation to calculate dilution ratio that you're going to get out of your fruit. It's not additive. End of story. Fresh fruit does not add alcohol. Generally, you're probably going to dilute your beer to a significant degree. Most fruits around 10 bricks, which is around 1040 gravity. So if you're doing anything above a 4% final ABV, you're diluting your beer. So take that into consideration. I mean, it doesn't really matter for us. Like, obviously, who cares? So what? It's diluted. This is 10%, even though it's 6. Say whatever you want. It doesn't really matter at the end of the day, but if you want to do it right, that's the calculation to do it the right way. This is, hey, we made it. Smooth beer. Okay. So I'm going to turn it over for questions here in about 2 minutes. I'm going to go over quickly a lot of information. We're not going to go over it. I'm just going to explain it. So I have a general guide to fruit usage rates here. It goes beer first fermented flavor, fruit first, and smoothie post-fermentation additions. Low, high, medium levels of fruit additions, and some just general stuff. Now, this is really nice and handy. This is 8 years of practical experience distilled down into a nice little graph for you. I have even more information here. That's 55 different fruits. That's 55 different explanations of how the flavor works when you ferment it and considerations of matching with your fruit, different recommended dosing guidelines and recommended stylistic guidelines that I personally like. Choose to ignore whatever you want. But this is where you're going to find out about strawberries being bad to ferment if you don't cook them first, and the fact that mangoes put off a lot of sulfur. This is basically everything I know. So that's it. This is fantastic. You can find it. You can find it at the Boron booth where I will be. I have a printed copy. In addition, you can find it on the internet at these two sites. But I highly recommend going back to that for all the really specific information. I mean, we only scratched the surface of all this fruit stuff. I wish I had more time, but I want to open it up to questions. So I really, really recommend giving that chart a once-over if you're serious about fruit and fruit fermentation, because there's just so much wonderful information there. Okay, questions. Let's get to it. If you have questions, please line up in the middle so that way it's caught on the recording.
Very good presentation.
Thank you.
What fruit have you used where it's like it tastes, it's a good idea at the first place, then you found out due to fermentation it just become like a rotten fruit taste?
Banana. Banana is tough. Very tough to get to come through post-fermentation. I don't like melon generally, but it's also really hard to ferment with as well. Watermelon will also be pretty sulfury, and a lot of the flavors are really delicate. So if you ferment different melons, the flavor might not be there. The sweeter fruits that I was talking about, anything that doesn't have some type of tannic or acidic punch to it is going to be more difficult to ferment with. And banana is basically a sweet potato, right? It's just starches and sugar. So when you ferment it, there's just not much left. So we've been surprised by a lot. There's a fruit called yellow mambin that's grown in Brazil. Blew my mind when we fermented that thing. It's also known as the hog plum. Didn't really taste like much, but post-fermentation, it was just a tropical bonanza of flavor. Hopefully that answers your question.
Fruit in lambic. You're putting fruit in lambic, but it pretty much ferments down. So how to get that aroma back in?
Great question. It's just use more fruit. I would for a fruited lambic, if you want some good intensity, I'd start at 2 to 3 pounds per gallon of fruit. Just don't be afraid to use a lot of fruit on a lambic. It'll chew down all that pulp and loss that you would normally see is slowly going to just condense and condense and condense, and you'll actually get pretty good yield when you wouldn't otherwise if you're just trying to turn something quick. So just use more fruit.
Do you ever use second-use fruit, and what's your guidance on if you want to use fruit multiple times?
Yeah, second-use fruit, great question. It's really fun. You're really only going to get a little bit of acidic impact and some mild color impact, but otherwise you're not going to get – it's like LaCroix, you know? It's a kiss of fruit is about all you get with the second-use stuff. I would look to Paquette. Which is a winemaking technique where you use second-use grapes. And what they do is they add water, add a bunch of grape skins and pumice, and then add sugar to ferment. So if I was using second-use, I would do something akin to that, where instead of adding water, I would just add wort, add my second-use fruit, and then add some sugar to – the French call it chapitalizing, but really you're just boosting the alcohol content. And there's nothing wrong with sugar. That's another thing. With this fruit fermentation, you can go well beyond the recommended historical narrative of using no more than 3% sugar in your beer or you're going to get, like, acetaldehyde flavors. We used up to 10% with no issue. It's that second nutrient dose add the sugar either at boil or when you add your fruit. It doesn't really matter. Just make sure you're adding enough nutrient, and you're not going to have a problem with sugar. And with the amount of fruit that you're using and the beer backing, it might dry out a little bit more than you planned. So I would mash a little bit higher to try to keep some dextrins around. But you don't need to be afraid of sugar either. So thank you for asking that.
When using foraged fruit, do you recommend leaning into the natural yeasts that are on it or mitigating that somehow? And how, if mitigating?
It's up to you what you want to do. You know, it's very romantic to use all the wild yeast and stuff, but it's also risky. But romance is what this is all about, right? That's the beauty of brewing. So, you know, I've done both. And what I do to clean it up is I'll just cook it, but gently. I'll add a little bit of water so it doesn't burn. I'll put it on a pot and on my stove and just stir constantly and use a thermometer and bring it up to about 145 to 155 degrees Fahrenheit. If you don't go above 170, you won't really have much aromatic loss, and you'll pasteurize it.
I love that your booth is called the Boron Booth. That's awesome. My question is edible flowers, so like hibiscus, honeysuckle, et cetera. When do you think it's a good time to add this? Do you add it into the keg? Do you use it in a whole form, or do you use it in a dry form? Maybe expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. We've done quite a bit. We use this. We have a whole flower blend that we use. It uses jasmine blossoms, apple blossoms, elderflower flowers, something else I'm forgetting. But we use that to make this like gin-infused fruit tart that we make. And we treat it like dry hopping. So we'll wait till fermentation's done. We'll put it in a bag, and we'll add it to the fermenter and steep. And then if we need to add more, we'll add more. But generally, we find after about 3 days or so, we get sufficient infusion. It also maintains all the more delicate flavors that you get from flowers. Definitely don't boil them.
Thank you for the breakfast smoothie.
You're welcome.
Just what the doctor ordered the morning after the night before. I'm assuming over the years you've developed relationships with growers?
Yes.
Okay, good. I need help, and there might be other people in this room that can help me. So about 10, 15 years ago, Cantillon and Dreyfontainen put out an APB for Scarbixa cherries, and a gentleman by the name of Chris Michelson wrote a monograph on Scarbixa and has provided Scarbixa to Dreyfontainen, and I imported trees from him. And there's a company in California called Dave Wilson Nurseries, and if you go to any nursery anywhere in the U.S., the vast majority of the trees that are provided to them have a Dave Wilson label on them. So these guys are cranking out millions of trees. And I've gone to them about five times now saying, I got this great cherry, and everybody wants it, and you guys got to make it. And they've blown me off every time. So there's a nice lady named Stacy who's kind of sort of a little bit listening to me now, and she's willing to let me bring her a pie and some beer so she can taste it. But the bottom line is I got to sell 5,000 of these things up front in order to get them over the hump to even bother dealing with it. So if there's anybody in here who knows a grower somewhere in the United States that might want to grow Scarbixa cherries, I'll be back at the back of the room afterward.
And yeah, find me later. We'll talk. I got some ideas.
God bless you. Thanks.
Are there any fruits where seed contact time is really beneficial to the beer or vice versa, where it's particularly detrimental?
Well, strawberry was the big one, detrimental. I haven't noticed a ton others that are the same level of detriment. Guava seeds are difficult to work with because they're basically rocks, and it can be a pain. But they're not going to give you off flavors. Two that I really like a lot are cherry, for obvious reasons. You get this almond-like characteristic. But something else that gives a similar flavor is apricot seeds. Mm-hmm. And the kernel in the apricot is used to make this spice called, I think it's malib. I don't know if I'm saying it right. But it's got this really wonderful kind of cherry, almondy thing going as well. Different than the cherry pit, but it's still got a really great character. So I would suggest anything with a big pit. This is just a hypothesis, but based off of the apricot and the cherry, which we've had really good luck with, I would think that peach might have similar impacts flavor-wise, or anything with a big pit, plum potentially too. So those are the two that pop to the top of my mind.
Thank you.
I have a question, two parts. First is a real basic newbie question. What about, like, I use peaches a lot because I grew up in peach country. And my beard turns brown. That's part of it. And then the other one is, you know, for a lot of the homebrewers, and especially for the competition people, is base beer. Or what beers are better, you know, in consideration for a base beer, you know, because some are very high in the bitterness level. And what do we have to think about with tannins and things from skins? So.
Oh, I'm actually really glad you asked that. I should have brought it up sooner. But acidity makes fruit taste better. Fruit is acidic. It's more acidic than beer. Beer 4 to 4 or 5, right? Most fruits around 3. Acidity works with fruit. It makes fruit taste more like fruit. You get better impact. You don't have to have a lot of acidity either. I know half of you are probably like, I don't like sour beer. That's fine. You don't need to make it sour. Just make it a little tart. Knock that down to like 3.8 pH, 3.7, 3.6. It's not going to feel overly acidic, but you're going to get more pop on your fruit flavors that way. So really, any beer style you use, my personal preference is at least a little tart and avoid hop bitterness. That's my two main goals with designing fruit beer. And then to the first part, it's hard to say, not knowing. You know, I mean, obviously you're a world-class brewer, so it's not probably oxidation. So it could just be fruit varietal. It could be skin. Could be anything. It's hard to say. Like, you know, like I was saying with strawberries, when they ferment, they just turn this really ugly, fleshy color, and just they're just ugly. And sometimes fruit's just ugly, and it could just be that. As long as it tastes good, I mean, who cares?
So continuing on with the question about seeds, the almond flavors, those apricot pits, peach, some of those have cyano compounds in them. Does that pose a risk of using those in the beer and soaking them for a long time?
I'm not a doctor or a lawyer, but no. You know, pawpaw is one of my favorite fruits. It's just this fantastic middle America tropical fruit, a holdover from the last ice age. And supposedly the seeds of that are also mildly toxic. Well, you know, I've put them in my beer before, and I haven't had a customer get sick yet, so, you know, knock on wood, I think it's going to be okay. And I think the level is so low in the cherries, I would not fret it at all. It can't be worse than the alcohol we're consuming, right?
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good morning.
I had a question. You just started talking about acids from fruits.
Yes.
At one time, this is more from a mead perspective, I used mangoes.
Yes.
So I was looking at it for the acid in lieu of the tartanic or citric acid to make the mead go. So I was wondering how you look at fruit from acid. You touched upon it, but a little bit more insight.
Yeah, that's actually a great point. A good question. So there's obviously a whole host of different acids, and they have different impacts. Citric is a really good way to mimic candy-like flavors because a lot of your sour candies are coated in citric acid. That's what makes them tart and sour. Yeah, so you can actually trick people into thinking it tastes more sour than it does, or more fruity than it does, or more candy-like than it does by using a little bit of citric, or using a fruit that's high in citric but in a low quantity. And then balancing the acidities is important too. So if you're using a sour beer base or a tart beer base, that's usually lactic-driven. If your fruit's high in citric but you still feel it's kind of missing a certain acidity that you want, then maybe look at adding like malic or something, or tartaric, like you said. It's all just about balancing, and it's important to realize you can use too much, too. So, like,
a little bit goes a long way. Like,
yes, passion fruit specifically is danger fruit. Smells and tastes great, but if you use too much, it's like drinking stomach acid. I'm sure we've all had a passion fruit beer that's been too much passion fruit.
My second question is an easy one. Can we get your slides through?
Yep.
How can we get your slides through the organization, AHA? Or
you can get them through they're on the app right now. They're on the app, and if you wanted a printed out version of that graph, come to the table 700.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for all the time and experience. What I was going to say was we're 4 years in our journey on our brewery, and what we found is summertime is fruit time, so with 25 taps, we have five bona fide fruit beers on, and that's just how we rotate in. And a lot of them are homebrew recipes, everything from strawberry blonde to a blood orange Belgian wit beer, which is kind of one of our flagships. We've done a bunch of different things, prickly pear, goza. But what I was going to say was what we found was make a really good beer and then accentuate it or make it better with fruit as opposed to just take a fruit and throw a beer on top of it, because you find that a lot of times, like you were saying, it doesn't pair well. And I was going to say this is what my question is, to Annie's point, one of the things we just found out just by talking to people that when we were making our peach pilsner and our peach sour, that counterintuitively, the peach will never taste right, and we tried extracts to try, and it tasted more artificial. But apricot made the peach pop. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it tasted peachier with apricot married with the peach. So are there other flavor combinations you found that all of a sudden, again, counterintuitively make everything better? Like we had to use the extract, the strawberry extract, to make the aroma pop more in the strawberry blonde. But do you have other ones where it's two different fruits making it taste like one fruit?
Yeah, great question. Well, there's the classic strawberry rhubarb, right? Rhubarb kind of brings the acidity that the strawberry is missing, so that's a good combo. Tropical anything with tropical anything is great. Pineapple, you know, it's got a pretty good aroma, and it's got some acidity, but it's really missing depth on the palate. So it pairs really well with something like mango. Mango and pineapple go really well together, and they kind of lift each other up where the two are missing. And I wouldn't say it makes it taste more pineapple-y or more mango-y, but it makes it taste more tropical-y. That's a great point about the apricot and the peach, though. And peach is tough, because what I found is that people either want to taste either canned peaches, canned yellow peaches, or they want to taste peach rings. And there's not really much in between. I spent a lot of time developing a relationship with this farmer in Spain that was growing white peaches, white freestone peaches. And I bought 3 pounds per gallon worth of peaches, and I made a 120-barrel batch. And it was my favorite peach beer I've ever made. It was so wonderful. It was like biting a fresh peach off of a tree. It sold like crap because people wanted yellow peach or they wanted peach rings, and it broke my heart. But that's a really good point about blending fruits in order to enhance the flavor of others. What I also found with flavor enhancement is vanilla. Vanilla is magic. It's the most amazing spice in the entire world. And you can use a little bit, not even enough where you can notice that there's vanilla, but if you use just a little bit, I'm talking like 30 grams for 30 barrels, so like 30 beans for 1,000 gallons, is enough to enhance the perception of sweetness without actually making it sweet, and it rounds it all together. So vanilla is another good cheat to smooth things over.
I was just going to make a point about vanilla. Working with Pete Slossberg, Wicked Pete, who became Chocolate Pete in later life, vanilla is like hamburger helper to chocolate. If you add a little bit of vanilla, all of a sudden it makes chocolate pop so much more. And it was one of those weird, again, counterintuitive things, like how does that work? But it does.
Yeah, vanilla is fantastic. It's just so wonderful.
I was wondering about the use of pectic enzymes with the beer.
Yeah, we use them. We use pectic enzyme and we use hemicellulase to great effect. I actually add a little bit of tannins sometimes, too, to our beers. You can buy tannin extracts from wine shops, homebrew shops, and a little bit. You don't need much because, again, bitterness and stuff, but a little bit actually helps stabilize color, prevent oxidation, stabilizes aroma, and it provides a little bit more grip on the palate. Yeah, did I answer that question? Sorry, I got lost talking about tannins. What was that?
When do you like to add it into the pectin enzyme?
Pectin enzyme. Yeah, okay. Thank you for asking that. The enzymes you got to be careful with, because if you add them and you don't have a heat step to render them unusable, they can keep working for months. So very specifically, don't use amylase enzymes outside of your mash, because you're going to over-attenuate your beer. Pectin enzymes, I like to add it to the fruit about an hour or so before I dose the fruit into the beer, and then I just let it all ride together. And that usually helps. We get a little bit better separation and efficiency that way.
Could you speak to perhaps yeast techniques that you're dealing with as you add 3 to 4 pounds per gallon of fruit? Are you co-pitching like a wine yeast, and how do you deal with pH drop causing basically yeast die-off because the acidity is too low for that?
Okay, well, it's a lot easier at my scale to do the things I'm about to say, but I buy a fresh pitch every single time, I prop it up every single time, and I prop it up in a low pH environment so it's accustomed to that. I also over-pitch greatly. And those things have really helped. I'm also basically like 95% Kvike or whatever that type of yeast is. That's almost all we use, and it just crushes fruit and beers and fermentations. It's a miracle yeast. I just don't understand why anyone would use anything else unless it's a lager yeast at this point in time. This stuff is just, it's a godsend. So we use that to great effect. And then the nutrient additions. I can't stress that enough. If you can get a little bit of zinc, you can buy it off of Amazon, add a little bit of zinc. It's like so little, but that helps as well. And if you're doing an acidification, we're getting a little off track here, but if you're doing an acidification, if you can get manganese as well, Lactobacillus uses a lot of manganese, so you want to add a little bit of manganese before your lacto step. That'll also help your lambics and stuff too. So zinc, manganese, extra nutrients. And a lot of yeast nutrients, beer nutrients specifically, don't have manganese in them or extra zinc in them. So be aware of that. I think that's it. We are out of time for questions. Like I said, I'll be at booth 700, and thank you all very much. Go fruit.